This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs, where the sun is shining. Last Saturday, we had snow. I am glad that you have joined me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Please also visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net and screeningsandyhook.net. If you wish to ask questions or make comments during the program, just email comment at spingola.email. I invite you to visit our Spingola Speaks chat room at spingola.chatango.com. If you wish to review the names of the guests that I have had the pleasure of interviewing on this program, just visit spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button on the left, and pick the year and the month, and you will see the guests with all of their links and all the information that you would need to see what we talked about and relevant links to the subject matter. I also have the names of future guests. And anyway, we're going to take calls in the third hour. But let me introduce our wonderful guests today. They are Michael Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of numerous books, including Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947. That book came out in 2010. I have it in hard copy. I first heard about the book from the late, great Michael Collins Piper, who passed away the end of May 2015, 4 years ago. It doesn't seem like that long ago. Anyway, our guest also has written other wonderful books. His latest is Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate, also a fabulous, fabulous book. And he's written several great books. His website is Thomas Goodrich, and that's the name on his books, Thomas Goodrich. But he likes to be called Mike. His real name is Michael Thomas Goodrich. So anyway, his website is thomasgoodrich.com, and there is a documentary that is available at hellstormdocumentary.com. My other esteemed guest is Paul English, who is the narrator of Hellstorm. His website is hellstormaudiobook.com, and he's going to share a few audio files with us today. And I'm just so grateful to have these two wonderful gentlemen back. They were here in March. And I usually number the documents when I create a new program each week, and they are numbered 2,300. I thought that was kind of significant, and that's just for this particular program. So happy to have you both.
My pleasure being here, Deanna, as always. Thank you so much for having us.
And I consider you just a real good friend. We've had some terrific conversations together. And Paul, likewise, I feel I've known you, because of what you've done, what you've accomplished. And, I thank you for putting this in a different format, because I think it's really great that you've done that. So thank you both.
That's great. It's almost like a family get-together here, Deanna. I mean, I love both of you guys so much, and gee, I don't have much of a family anymore, and maybe this is it. But I'm so excited to be back on your program again, and I think way back 2012, probably, or 11, I'm not sure, you were the very first individual to offer me a platform to talk about the book Hellstorm. I've never forgotten that, and I know you were. I just can't remember what the date was. But,
I will find it during the breaks, but I know that as soon as Mike mentioned you on his program, that I went looking for you. Mm-hmm. And, first I bought the book, of course, and then I knew that I had to find you. And some of the best people that I've met have been people, authors such as yourself, people on the internet. And it's just the internet, although it has its negatives, certainly, it has certainly opened up a whole new world for alternative radio and alternative messages. And
you know something else, what the internet has done, almost silently and quietly, it's created, as we're testament today, the three of us together. I've never met you, never met Paul either, and yet we know each other front and back. I think it's like
absolutely.
It's like a cyber family, and I mean that in a good sense too, because we know one another, we love one another, we understand each other. We also recognize the foibles that we may have, the ups and downs, things like that. It's what people, when they meet eye to eye, we experience that ourselves. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great time to be alive, quite honestly.
It is, yes. And life can be joyous despite all of the really negative things that are occurring. Mm-hmm. Friends bring joy, and certainly you've brought joy into my life. And Paul, thank you so much for what you've done. It's terrific.
It's nice to be back. It's nice to be back. You don't know I call him Mr. Goodrich, don't you?
Well,
I got so confused when I first, they said, I'm this. I said, I don't know what's going on, Mr. Goodrich.
Is it Tom? Is it Mike? Is it Mr. Goodrich? Is it Sir? Is it, Your Honor?
Sir's okay. That's good. Are you, yes. Like it when I'm...
Well, I prefer Sir, by the way.
Yeah, Sir is good.
Just call me Sir Mike.
Sir Mike, okay.
But, you know, Paul, he acts diffident, and he acts, oh, shucks, sometimes like that. But Paul is one of the most incredible talents I've ever had the fortune of meeting. I thought this for years. I thought the only ingredient missing from my book, Hellstorm, was a voice. To give a voice, actual voice, to the voiceless victims of the world's worst war. And that's the dedication in the book, as you may remember, Deanna. But I've always wanted that voice. And to be quite honest, I never imagined I could find that voice, or the voice find me in this case. But lo and behold, Paul and I got together about a year ago. We had known each other, how would you say that, Paul? We knew of one another. We've talked together, but we weren't tight like we are now. But we started.
The first thing we did was when we were doing that little thing. We maybe mentioned it on the previous show when we were on with you, Deanna, back in March. It was when we did the thing about Dresden, if you remember. You were in Europe at the time, and last February. So not this February, but last February. Mm-hmm. We did something about Dresden, and that's when we were talking about Victor Gregg, if you remember, the British guy. He's probably still alive as well, mm-hmm. and all those sorts of things. So that's, yeah, we didn't release that, don't think, at the time, for very sensible reasons. But then that was the ground, you know, that was kind of breaking the ice a bit. And then when I spoke to you again in the autumn last year, that's when we got this thing rolling. Yeah.
Yeah, I think anybody listening right now can appreciate Paul's talent right off, just after hearing him. He's got a wonderful voice, a rich, resonant, passionate, powerful voice. And he puts this all to good use in the narration of the book, the audiobook Hellstorm. Apparently, I wasn't paying attention back when we first met, Paul, about your ability to do this, because we did talk about it. But as I knew from personal experience, having a good voice is one thing. Reading an entire book, narrating a book is another. Does one have the patience, the time, to do this? Well, I had tried it myself because, as I said, I really did want a narration, the voice for this book, and people had encouraged me to do that. And I gave it a shot. I spent a day, I was going to go do it and try to do it seriously. I couldn't even do a page and a half. I remember that vividly. It was very frustrating. And here's someone who wrote the book and rewrote the book and knew the book front and back. And yet I could still not do it without committing errors and, the breathing thing, as you know, Paul, so well, things like that. I gave it up.
But stop breathing.
Stop breathing. Yes.
That's what I do. I stop breathing halfway through it.
Yeah.
But in the face.
After listening, I have not listened to the entire narration all the way through. I've heard bits and pieces of it. And after hearing, I'm satisfied that this is the best possible narration possible for this book. So I'm extremely happy. The audiobook's only been out a couple of weeks now, but already Paul and I are getting some idea about the impact the book is going to make. And by the way, Deanna, and your listeners who have read the book, let me say this. As appreciative I am of those who have bought and read the book and perhaps told others about it, I think that the audiobook has the power to go ever so much further. I would think double and triple the audience. I would imagine that, let's be honest, reading a book is hard work. You've got to really set your mind to it. You've got to have the time first and foremost, which most people don't anymore, but you also have to have pretty good eyesight actually, or very good bifocals. And so, that's understood.
I don't wear glasses. I love to read, but I know that there's another whole group of people that would prefer an audio of something so that they can, people who, when I used to be on the road traveling in my job, I used to have an audio file going on all the time because I felt that just driving was simply a big waste of time. Mm-hmm. I covered 5 states and it would have been just a terrible waste of time, mm-hmm, to just be driving for all that time and not be feeding my mind with something.
Mm-hmm.
And so this absolutely does provide a venue for people, not just who drive, but people who prefer an audio vision or version of a particular book. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, yes.
Yeah, you're right. You're right about that. It does seem, and it is a waste of time because we sit there dwelling upon this and that. And generally, if you're like me, it's dwelling upon things negative when I'm driving, when I have a lot of time on my hands in airports where I sit and do nothing, absolutely nothing. But this is a way to not only learn a lot about what took place during World War II, but it's also a good way to spend your time. It's a learned experience where you can actually listen to someone else doing the work, that is Paul, mm-hmm, telling you the story and telling it ever so well, too. Paul mentioned the man, and his name was Greg, Paul?
Victor Gregg, yeah, Victor Gregg.
A famous voice in the UK, but we have one too in the US, David McCullough, the man who did Ken Burns' Civil War series so
right,
eloquently and so professionally, and but now we've got that also for Hellstorm. I'm happy to say, and I know that's saying a lot, But this is truly what this is all about. It's as good as it can be. And finally, the voiceless victims of the world's worst war finally have not only a voice, but they've got a professional, powerful, passionate voice to tell their stories. And no
and
author could ask for more.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, no author could ask for more.
Exactly. And the breathing thing is, mm-hmm. you don't think about that, because usually when you're reading a book or listening to a book, who's thinking about what breathing? But yeah. when you're reading, you have to gear your breaths at the right time in the right place. And people are supposed to breathe out of their nose or breathe in through their nose. Mm-hmm. So how do you do all that? And keep your mind on what you're talking about, and talk about something with such emotion and passion.
Maybe after this first break, Deanna, we can actually play a clip and people can understand why I'm so excited about the audiobook and
Absolutely.
Paul.
Anytime so. You want to play a clip, you have the schedule of the breaks, and the clips are, well, we're coming up on a break in about 3 minutes, less than 3 minutes. But so you'll just have to time them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should mention here also that the narration of the German version of Hellstorm is also in progress now. That's Höllensturm. It's being narrated by a German. And I think he's doing a very good job. I'm not going to say his voice is equivalent to Paul's. I doubt if anybody's is. But nevertheless, our German friends, those listening right now who prefer to hear something in German or read in German, that's going to be available in probably 3 months at the most. It should be done by then in a package and out there for people to hear. But that's also going on right now. So, yeah, it's just a wonderful way of telling people this awful, terrible story. It's been hidden for the last 70-some years, and now they're going to have it in their grip, and their ears will hear exactly what did happen.
Right. And so many people do not have a clue about the real history of World War II. They consider it the good war. I can't imagine any war when even one person is slaughtered to be good. I'm just totally anti-war completely. And
anybody who would come up with the term the good war has to be a perverted soul out there, quite honestly.
A psychopath.
Yes, a degenerate of some sort. A good war. There's never been such a thing as a good war. There have been things like this, the American Revolution, for instance. It was good in the sense that we gained our freedom, but it wasn't good for the people themselves, the people who died, the people who were crippled. And that's as close as I could ever come to a good war. And that's not even a good war, by the way.
Right.
If we can't work it out by political means or other means, honest means, for God's sakes, let's don't start killing each other
right.
to prove a point.
Absolutely.
It seems the United States has been in that business, of course, ever since its beginning, the business of war, the business of aggression. And in fact, this nation lives on war, quite honestly. Let's mm-hmm. face it. Everything about it's militarized. Everything about this nation right now.
Everything.
Everything.
Entertainment.
Advertisements. Yes,
right.
Everything. Like video games, nonsense. Before every sports performance, you've got to have the colors brought out. By who? Bricklayers, bakers, insurance salesmen? No, by the military. They have to drag out the flag. They have no more a right to do that than, like I said, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker.
Yes.
But this is America, so that's the reality of it all. But yeah, certainly, of all wars, the last war I would name as good would be World War II. It was the most evil, despicable abomination the earth has ever witnessed, World War II. And the secret that's kept it hidden for the past 70 years, that's a terrible abomination in itself. So it's just nothing but a horrendous part of world history that we've apparently passed through. We really haven't gotten through it completely yet. It still goes on to this very day.
It does. Absolutely, it does. All righty. We're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. And, okay, stay with us.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony.
All right, we are back with our guest today. And they are Michael Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of Hellstorm, and Paul English, who is the narrator of that monumental book. And the website for that narration is hellstormaudiobook.com. Mike, we've done over 20 programs together.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, that many? That many. Plus, our little chats.
Yeah. Well, then there's no mystery there. Is there, Deanna? We know each other pretty well by now.
Yeah, for sure.
And, Paul and I, we might as well move in together. We've been talking to each other so much over the last few weeks. Well, we won't do that, will we, Paul?
No, we won't.
Yeah, so
we're not doing anything like that. I'm British, you know. I don't know that sort of thing.
But yes, it's again, it's back to the internet. We can become friends, brothers, sisters, without ever shaking hands or looking into each other's eyes. It's a wonderful time to be alive. And I'm going to say this to you also, Deanna. Thank you so very much for having me on so many times. I must have been saying something that you appreciated, I don't know. Maybe there's something else there. I don't know what it is, but just thank you for giving me a platform to say the things I do say when I come on your program. I really appreciate that.
Well, we always have wonderful chats, and I'm happy that we've talked that many times. And
we know each other's life pretty well, too.
Yes, we do. We certainly do. Absolutely.
That's the same with Paul and I. Yeah, I ask him sometimes what he's having for supper, because he does a lot of cooking. I do a lot of cooking in my home also, so we're kind of like housewives, I guess you'd say, in a way.
It was hamburger tonight, just to keep filling in, okay?
Okay.
I've made dinner also already. I made black bean chili.
Oh.
And I also ate a little bit of it for lunch. Oh, it's so good. I got the recipe out of the All Animals magazine that I take, because I love animals.
Yep.
And but it's really good. It has fire roasted tomatoes and just all kinds of really neat stuff in it. And I got some nice from the Amish farmer. I got some Italian, it's Italian sausage. Mm-hmm. And it just had, oh, it's so good. Gosh, I wish I could send you some.
I'm making vegetable soup tonight. That's what's on the stove right now. But, you know, potatoes, carrots, celery, even some barley in there, and all sorts of vegetables. But when I went to put in a dash or two of basil, I had the wrong opening, and it opened up. So we're going to have basil soup tonight.
Oh, basil is good. It's really good for you.
But it really, it's there's a lot of it in there. I've never had that much, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
I like your pronunciation. So you have tomatoes, don't you?
And you have tomatoes, I know.
We have tomatoes.
British.
You have basil, but we have basil.
Basil?
We just call it basil, right?
Basil.
And like then the other one that I quite like is you have, how do you pronounce it? Is it oregano? Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Huh?
Whereas we say oregano.
Oh, that's totally wrong.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, I'll be back later. it's completely wrong. You're absolutely right. It's wrong.
It's just plain wrong.
How did we, you know, we're speaking Paul's native tongue, the tongue that was the language that originated in England. How did we, yes, how did we bastardize it? How did we,
It's the Irish influence. It's the Irish.
Really?
Oh.
No, seriously, that's my take. We've got some good Irish friends up in London. Mm-hmm. Done them for years, and they are very keen on their trips to America. In fact, I think they've got a pad somewhere in some nice place in South Carolina or North Carolina, somewhere like that. They've got a nice place anyway. And every now and again when they come back, the blend between Irish and American is really distinct. You can really get where a lot of the tonal sounds comes from. So it's a certain area of Ireland, because the Irish accent varies all over the place. Well, Northern Ireland is quite an aggressive sounding accent compared to Southern Ireland, which can be very musical and fluid. And, so yeah, that's my take on it. Anyway, I often wondered as a young person where the American accent developed from, but I think it's definitely a hefty dose of Irish that's in there.
That may be true, Paul, but the difference between schedule and schedule.
Right.
Who introduced that? Where did that come from? Sounds like somebody really angry with the English language to call it schedule. Or maybe that's the Germanic influence. Maybe, we've got so many Germans here and other Scandinavian type of people. You know, I lived in Maine for a couple of years, and, there's a town in northern Maine that looks like Calais in France, but the natives pronounce it Calais.
Oh gosh, that's hard. That's hard. Okay, with that, we're gonna go to a break. We'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good. To live in harmony. It starts.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Michael Thomas Goodrich and Paul English, and we're talking about Hellstorm, the death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947, and Paul is the narrator, and we've got a nice stretch of time here, which would be really good for some clips from the book. And to find out all about the book and how you can download it, play it in your car, just visit the website, and that is hellstormaudiobook.com, and scroll down, and all the questions you might have about the audiobook are answered there. Correct?
Yeah, they are. Oh. Would you like me to play a clip?
Please.
Here we go. I'll tell you what it is afterwards. Actually, I don't know which one it is. Chapter 4 this is from. When I went into his office, he held out his hand to me and asked, "Have you had some rest, my dear?" Slightly surprised by the question, I replied, "Yes, mein Führer." "Good. It won't be long before I have some dictation for you." Later, as Traudl wrote, Hitler spoke. "It is not true that I or anyone else in Germany wanted war back in 1939. It was desired and provoked solely by those international politicians who either come from Jewish stock or are agents of Jewish interests. After all my many offers of disarmament, posterity simply cannot pin any blame for this war on me. After a struggle of 6 long years, which in spite of many setbacks will one day be recorded in our history books as the most glorious and valiant manifestation of the nation's will to live, I cannot abandon this city, which is the German capital. Since we no longer have sufficient military forces to withstand enemy attacks on this city, it is my desire to share the same fate that millions of other Germans have accepted. People and the armed forces have given their all in this long and hard struggle. The sacrifice has been enormous, but my trust has been misused by many people. It was therefore not granted to me to lead the people to victory. The efforts and sacrifices of the German people in this war have been so great that I cannot believe that they have been in vain. At approximately 3:15 p.m., April the 30th, Adolf Hitler retired to his room, placed a pistol to his head, then squeezed the trigger. Beside him, his newlywed wife, Eva, also lay dead. After administering poison to their children, Josef and Magda Goebbels bid farewell to those remaining in the compound, wrote one witness who watched as the couple prepared to leave the bunker for their final act in the courtyard above. Going over to the coat rack in the small room that had served as his study, he donned his hat, his scarf, his long uniform overcoat. Slowly, he drew on his kid gloves, making each finger snug. Then, like a cavalier, he offered his right arm to his wife. They were wordless now. So were we three spectators. Slowly, but steadily, leaning a bit toward each other, they headed up the stairs to the courtyard. So that was from, that wasn't actually the clip I thought I was going to play. How about that?
Oh, but that is, it is very touching.
Yes, it is.
It is. It is.
I should say this, that, I think for roughly 2 weeks, a little less perhaps, but the Battle of Berlin had been going on, in which virtually every man, woman, and child offered something. It just depends whether they were nurses or actually kids fighting, knocking out Russian tanks. But this was a desperate struggle, and it was perhaps our finest hour, quite honestly, in the white world, because no one shirked the responsibility. Everybody understood what was going on. Yes, this was the Alamo of Germany. And Hitler had hoped against hope, of course, had waited till the last moment before he did this. Otherwise, he'd been captured and paraded through Moscow and probably put in a cage like an animal, wild animal, had he not killed himself. But there are people who think to this very day that Adolf Hitler and perhaps Eva also escaped by a plane at the last moment and flew, I think, first to Spain and then to Argentina, and where they lived out their life there in Argentina. That's rubbish. That's malarkey. That's BS. Hitler told the people of Germany, "It's my duty to stay here at all costs because I'm your leader. I'm the one. You followed me throughout this war, and I'll not leave you at the end of the war." And so Hitler's always been a man of his word. Hitler did not escape in the night in an airplane to Spain and then to Argentina. He stayed there, and he died there. Simple as that. That's what we expect out of a man of a leader. Leader of integrity and honor and bravery. But that's a very touching excerpt, Paul, by the way. But that's the nature of Hellstorm, isn't it? It's the people themselves doing the talking. It's not me, the author, who holds it together. This is the people themselves telling what it was like, what they saw, what they experienced, what they felt at that moment. And there's a tremendous sense of immediacy when someone else who witnessed this is telling you that story. I don't think history can be put together any better than that, where those who participated are basically the author of the book. They're telling you all about it. I love, whenever I get the rare chance to read a book, I love first person, personal accounts like that, because quite honestly, a narrator or a author themselves can stick in their bias, their agenda, if you will. And I prefer listening to the people themselves, the good and the bad of it. But no, that was a tremendous reading, Paul.
Indeed.
Well, it's, you know, that thing you were saying there, Mr. Goodrich, about the escaping and all these other stories that will continue to pop up. I've no doubt about that. I mean, the question to ask really is who benefits from the promotion of such stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it's often the case that the raw simplicity of the situations in history are far more alarming in many ways and far more powerful than any sort of spun up story. Nearly always. Mm-hmm. It's the direct nature of the whole thing. You were mentioning earlier, I think before the break, about the good war, and it wasn't a good war and all this kind of stuff, and that people get a little bit lost. Somebody sent me a link the other day to a video about 20 minutes long. It's been up for about 4 days. It must have had about 110,000 views by now. I don't know how this happens, by the way. This is a mystery to me, but not to those people who are able to do it. However, it's about 20 minutes, and it's about the real story of Adolf Hitler, or so it purports to be. And I didn't know how to respond to it, because I thought, good grief, modern people of today, because it's a sort of, you know, it's a brand new production, are just as easily bamboozled as every idiot before us. The stuff was just packed, from my perspective, with the most comical, obvious nonsense about how this was the most evil man that ever lived. And I'm watching this and I'm going, don't these people, and I'm not sort of, it's not a matter of actually judging these people, although you can't help it. Don't they ever get reacquainted with the idea of the question mark and asking questions? They don't ask any. They don't ask one. If you actually stand back and listen to these narratives that come across, there is absolutely no questioning of these things. Oh no, that's the way it was. Are you sure? Does that really add up? Does that really make sense? It doesn't make sense. And so I would say that that's possibly one of these differences that we're always looking for. Some of us just have this itch that we have to scratch. We're going, that's not quite right. That's nonsense. And other people go, no, because it's been broadcast for 60, 70 years and it's like this. Must be that way. I'm going, that's the very opposite of that. It's the very opposite of that.
Yeah.
And we're like on different planets. Seriously, it's extremely strange.
Yeah,
I'm sure I'm not describing anything new to either of you, but I do feel like that a lot.
But yeah, it's almost as if a few of us have a curiosity gene in our body and the rest don't. Because there's no other explanation as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, there's fear, there's cowardice, there's worries about losing your job, perhaps your family. But still, it's almost as if it doesn't really matter. That is the truth. There is no question mark. It's basically acceptance of, no matter how preposterous a so-called, quote, truth is, it really doesn't matter. They just want to get through this life with as few scrapes as possible. I understand that. I think we all three understand it. Nobody wants to spend a life of constant fighting and constant threat and constant peril all around us. But nevertheless, that's what curiosity is all about. No matter how many times a lie has been told, we still have to find out for ourselves, is this really true? Or does it smell like a lie, and is it a lie? I mean, that's the dilemma we face. But you know, the good news about that, Paul, is, when you do say something that people understand as an obvious truth, then there's something that transforms them, ever so slightly perhaps, but nevertheless they've got that truth stuck in their head and they'll never be the same again. At least they recognize it as the truth. For instance, you're talking about Adolf Hitler. Anybody who reads anything objective about Adolf Hitler cannot come away with that idea that here's an evil man, a terrible man who lived on hate and enjoyed terrorizing the world or trying to take it over. I mean, when you start reading personal accounts, honest, personal, unbiased, objective accounts about Hitler, you have to come up with the other answer. This was really a great, good man all the way through. Yes, war is a terrible thing. And sometimes you're forced to do a few things that are horrible, it seems, at least. But nevertheless, we're talking about an extremely brave man who fought World War I, who did some incredibly brave things, running back and forth errand as a courier. You know, that's one of the most lethal businesses you could possibly do in a war, especially trench warfare, and yet he did it. He volunteered for stuff like that. He fought to the end. He fought from his hospital bed, even after he had been wounded and gassed. I'll bring this up.
I think,
up.
You know, in retrospect, if you look at anybody's life, anybody's, you can pick holes in it. No one's perfect.
Right.
No one. And I'm sure Mr. Hitler had his problems. And certain aspects of this little presentation were showing them. But there were other things that were just ludicrously silly that irritate me a lot. You know, there's always this thing that he couldn't paint. Look, I know he's not Rembrandt, but he could. Right?
Yes.
It's quite a thing. He was fine. He was, you know, so that didn't happen for him. And I'm not here defending him one way or the other. I don't know every single thing about it. But what we do know, I tend to feel, is when we're being lied to in a big way. And when there is still, I mean, this is amazing when you think about it. Here we are, some 70 odd years since cessation of hostilities, since he disappeared. And yet there are more articles probably still to this day being generated about him than anything else. They're having to bolt the lies on top every single day, nonstop. It's ridiculous. And I would imagine, you know, obviously there's a great, there's a vested interest in the British establishment maintaining that because they were culpable in terms of what they did. They were. And, the whole thing is about the rottenness of these elites. Let's call them that. They're just, you know, they're rotten. And I was looking at, I always like the comments, about 2000 comments on this video. Most of them are completely ridiculous, but after a couple of days, the proper ones started to come through and they're good. They're good. It's always nice to see people, you know, start putting the case for Churchill being the greatest, you know, version of human excrement that ever walked the face of the earth, as far as I'm concerned. And it's just, it's incredible. And yeah, it shows you the power of the brainwashing. The problem we have with propaganda is it works. It does work.
On a very large percentage of our people, it does work. It's been proven. However, you know, Hitler though, You had a good example about his artwork. People have constantly tried to belittle and besmirch his ability. He was a good sketcher. I'm not going to say, you know, he wasn't a Van Gogh or Rembrandt, anything like that. But having painted roughly 20 years of my life for a living, I can tell you his stuff would sell. It's that good. His architecture paintings. He also had a dreamier side, but when you watch enough of Adolf Hitler on video, on the film back then, a certain consistency comes out every time I watch something with Adolf Hitler in it. Whether it's a speech or whether it's out in the countryside, he actually had a very strong, he had an empathy for virtually everybody he talked to. Mm-hmm. He had an understanding of what they're going through. Have you ever seen Hitler just stop his limousine, his driver, so he can get out by the side of the road and go over and take in his hand a small bouquet that a little peasant girl is holding for him and the smile on his face? Or when someone brings their dog up and pay it. I don't see that in any other politician on earth, by the way. I see a sham and a fraud depending on how desperately they need to portray themselves as some sort of man of the people. Hitler was doing this without the pretension, without this stage rigging type of approach to things. He just did it because that's what he did. Mm-hmm. And that, when you see those things, how can you possibly say that this is a man of evil? You can say all the things that the propagandists told you to say. Well, he killed 6 million Jews, and well, he started World War II, and he slaughtered the Russians and the Ukrainians and people like that, and all the terrible things that propaganda say he did. You can believe that, or you can ignore what you see and what you know in your heart yourself. And unfortunately, a great percentage of our people do the latter. They, in spite of what they know to be truth, they ignore that because it's safer believing the lie. You can continue with your job and have your family. Nobody's going to come after you. You won't be attacked. That's my only explanation for why we have so many people who do absolutely nothing, who continue with the lies and the propaganda.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, gentlemen, we have a quick 3-minute break, and we'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest. Yes.
Do we have time for another clip, Paul?
We have 3 minutes in this segment.
Okay, that may not make it then. It may be a little more.
But as soon as we come back, we'll have a good 20-minute span or 18-minute span.
Great.
One thing about your book, your books, and you say that, that you let the people do the talking. Every single paragraph, nearly, well, most of them have references.
Mm-hmm.
You cite your sources so that people may go to those sources and verify for themselves. You're not making this stuff up. This is firsthand. People are telling you, and then you're telling us what they said. And before you mentioned men, women, and children, and you have one in chapter 4, talks about, it says, adding even more horror to the scene. Terribly burned and mutilated zoo animals screamed in pain amid the rubble. Now the Allies purposefully, they did this on purpose to go after animals, that magnificent tigers and elephants and, this just makes me sick.
Yeah, there was something toward the end of the war called the Targets of Opportunity, in which the Allies informed their aviators to shoot anything that moved in Germany, anything that moved.
Yeah.
Buses, trains, barges, boats, people riding their bikes to go get bread, kids in schoolyards, animals in zoos, kill everything that moves. And unfortunately, so many airmen, so many pilots did exactly as they were ordered to, urged to. In other words, it was, we're talking some, 20-something-year-old pilots in there, that is probably an early day form of a video game type of thing where it was fun, actually fun. But yeah, the animals in Berlin may have been killed by the bombardments from cannons, things like that, not particularly pointed out. I don't know that for a fact. But nevertheless, the object was to kill everything that moved in Germany. In other words, destroy Germany utterly. And the animals were part of Germany. In fact, as you know from the book itself, I have accounts of people watching these wonderful birds coming back, these large birds, the storks, coming back from the south in the spring in Germany. That is March, April, May, coming back to build their nests and raise their chicks before they go south again next winter. Of Soviet soldiers actually shooting these birds out of the sky, just having fun shooting them. Or of the Allies just simply killing cattle because they were German cattle. This war was good. It was not good in so many ways. I mean, we're just naming a few of them here, but yeah, it was the most vicious depravity the earth has ever seen, in my opinion. World War II.
That says it all. Alrighty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back with these two fine gentlemen who should both be knighted.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Michael Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947. It has been out for 9 years, and something wonderful has occurred. Paul English, our other guest, became the narrator for this book, and it is now available as an audiobook at hellstormaudiobook.com. And Mike's website is thomasgoodrich.com. Anyway, it was just a slaughter. And many of the people that were doing the bombing came home and could not live with what they had done. I had an uncle who was just, it destroyed him. And that's true for a lot of people, I believe. People aren't designed to slaughter one another. It doesn't matter how much propaganda they have been incited by. Our natures are that we should not slaughter each other.
Well, not like that. Definitely not like that. Not waging war on women and children.
No.
That's the big difference, really, with World War II.
Yes.
That's where it starts to become unhinged.
Yes.
Yeah. You know. Well, this is.
Yep. Oh, go ahead.
Well, this depravity that we call World War II, this evil. Well, English words haven't developed far enough that we can actually describe what occurred in World War II. We just simply don't have the words. Hellstorm, that's the best I could come up with, but it still doesn't describe what's in this book. Now, this audio book. But it's something that hasn't stopped. We're acting like, or at least we're talking like it's in the past. It's not. It's in the very present, and it's going to be in our future unless we do something about it. What's going on in the Middle East right now is just, in my opinion, a continuation of World War II, in so many ways. In other words, what worked then they think will work now, and apparently it is. United States, we haven't been in control. We Americans have not been in control of our government for decades and decades and decades. And we're living the results right now. We're living the consequences of us sleeping while this Jewish infrastructure has taken over every part of American society, virtually everything. And their hatred of some of the nations in the Middle East and their desire to get rid of them, all they had to do is basically a little propaganda here and press a few buttons there, and they've got the Americans not only fighting and dying for greater Israel, but for paying for the war itself, paying to fight and die. That's going on to this very day. This performance, of course, occurred during World War II, basically, getting the nations, starting with UK, our good old Winston Churchill, and the United States, our even better FDR, putting them on the side of the Jewish worldwide power grid, and that's the consequence. That's what happens. We took out the greatest nation perhaps in the entire world, that is Germany, certainly the leader of Europe at the time, a nation that was actually fighting for us, all of us white. Actually, this, I can go further than that. Paul, interrupt me if you disagree, but Germany was fighting for more than just the white world. It was fighting for the world, period, to try to free the world. It's very simple. Hitler's statements and comments on this, that says it right there as far as I'm concerned. But, of course, the propaganda and the Jewish hatred of Germany and the fear that Germany might succeed beyond what they had already succeeded in, that is creating this miracle almost overnight in Germany. That was very scary stuff, and, of course, we know that what happened then. This gang rape of Germany with America, the Soviet Union, and UK and France, and we simply took out our leadership, And that's the reason we're so hopeless and forlorn right now to this very day. We have no real leadership in the world. Italy is starting to stand up, thank God. Austria, Hungary, Poland, it's finally coming around. But ever so slowly, will there be enough time for them to finally overwhelm and take back what's ours? That is our continent, Europe. But maybe I'm reading way too much into this, but I think it's a very simple progression from looking at World War II and seeing what's going on right now and what will go on in the future. Right now, as we know, they're always, the U.S. is always ratcheting up the tension against Iran. And of course, that's Israel's greatest enemy right there. I don't think it's any coincidence that now we're looking at Iran. This entire scenario that I'm talking about, it could have devastating consequences because it just so happens that Iran is backed by not only Russia, but China. And, we're entering a potentially world-ending period right now, unless we get a grip on this. And apparently we still haven't. But, that's the good news about shows like Deanna's and, the internet in general is that more and more people, more and more important and powerful people are paying attention. They're suddenly, I don't want to be too despondent on this or too pessimistic, but perhaps the internet and people like Deanna, who are having a much greater impact on this world than we could ever imagine at this point. I for a fact, I won't name names, of course, but I, for a fact, know some extremely important, powerful people who do perfunctory. It's almost a religion with them. They do listen to all the alt-right media they can possibly get because they know they're catching another side of this entire scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what gives me confidence. That's what gives me the spring to jump out of bed every morning is because, in my opinion, we're winning. My only concern is will we have enough time to win?
Right.
And then perhaps put an end to what was World War II. Stop this nonsense that's going on to this very day. But I don't know if Paul agrees with me, everything I've said so far.
I do. I mean, I do. And I think, I tend to think that World War III began the minute that World War II ended. It's just being conducted by different means. And I think the other, an aspect of inquiring into World War II, although for, I suppose the big event for most people, within recent living memory would be 9/11. If certain pennies drop, and they have done for millions of people around 9/11, then there's a series of questions that come up after that. One of them is, if they were lying to me about this, what else have they been lying to me about? And I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much fog put around World War II by the official court historians. There has to be, because they wouldn't have anticipated the free flow of information that we've been able to enjoy for the last 20 years. I know that steps are afoot to shut it down, and they may be partially successful in all sorts of ways. But once you've had certain questions thrown in your head with regards to World War II, you begin to see that, oh, hang on. This is not an isolated incidence of deceptive communication. Good grief. This appears to be the rule. That's the next thing you get to.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, once you begin to question these things, that veneer of authority, which they sit in, which has got most people being quite compliant with, begins to disintegrate. And it has to disintegrate because it's not good. It attracts the worst sort of individuals who want to be in power purely because they don't want anybody else to be in power, not because they could do anything with it. If we look at all the characters, the leading characters from World War II, why is it that we are more fascinated with Mr. Hitler than with anybody else? We're not fascinated with Stalin. No one's fascinated. No one says, wow, communist Russia was fantastic. There's a civilization. No one says that. You don't have to sit around and ponder it very long. They just literally, you just go, that looks grotty and useless and rubbish and mad. What's going on? Why are those people dying? Oh, I see. And then, of course, the real narrative starts to come out. Then you realize that the real narrative is never being communicated with any force, with any muscle behind it. It never becomes the established predominant view. You always have, you know, challenging views, but the predominant view is the one that's got all the money behind it by the people that own the press, who then you begin to understand why they never relent with this. They can't. Mm-hmm. They've got to get, they're like hamsters on the wheel. They've got to keep the lie spinning 24 hours a day. They've just got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we come along, I suppose, in many ways, like little wasps and irritants, and start stinging them in their tender bits. And they don't like it too much, which is good for us. And we just need an awful lot more stinging power. We're a swarm. We shouldn't think of ourselves, we need to be an enormous swarm of stinging, foul-tempered hornets, because we've got a lot of things to sting.
You have such a way really of do. Making things very definitive, and I like your analogy.
Do we have
something like that?
You know. Do we have a few minutes here, Deanna?
We have about 7.
Well, we'll throw this one in. This is about 3.5 minutes long. Here we go.
Okay.
By noon, February the 14th, a strange silence settled over what once was Dresden. The city was absolutely quiet, Götz Berglinde remembered. The sound of the fires had died out. The rising smoke created a dirty, grey pall which hung over the entire city. The wind had calmed, but a slight breeze was blowing westward, away from us. And then, shattering the calm, came the sounds. I suddenly thought I could hear sirens again, continues Berglinde. And sure enough, there they were. I shouted, and by then we could already hear the distant whine of engines. The roar of the engines grew louder and louder. As US bombers began blasting the rubble to dust, American fighter planes zeroed in on the thousands of refugees at the park, along the river, and in other open spaces. Recalled Anna Marie Wayman. We looked up and saw how they flew lower and lower. They're coming here. We screamed. A few men took over and gave commands. Split up, scatter, run into the fields, down on your faces. While we were lying in the dirt, our hands clawing at the earth as if we wanted to crawl inside it, they came after us, wave after wave, circling, flying low, shooting with their machine guns into the defenseless people. Popping noises right and left, clods of earth flying up, screams. Like everyone else, I expect, I prayed. Dear God, please protect me. A few seconds pause as the planes circled in order to come back at us again. The men screamed, up, up, run on, run toward the trees. But again, that popping noise as they fired without mercy into the people, and screams and clods of earth flying around. I took Hildy by the hand, and without turning round once, without even looking to see how many people did not get up again, we ran. Panic broke out, said 15-year-old Gerhard Kernemund. Women and children were massacred with cannon and bombs. It was mass murder. While we literally clawed ourselves into the grass, I personally saw at least 5 American fighter bombers, which from an altitude of approximately 120 to 150 meters, opened fire with their cannon on the masses of civilians. My companion was killed beside me in this attack. There was a hole in his back the size of a palm. Near the park, zookeeper Otto Sailor Jackson watched in stunned disbelief as one American pilot mowed down people running in the street. He attacked several times, flying very low, firing from cannon and machine guns into the refugees. Then he flew low over the zoo and made several firing runs at anything he could see that was still alive. In this way, our last giraffe met her death. Many stags and other animals, which we had managed to save, became the victims of this hero. Although the raid lasted only 10 minutes, the Americans returned the next day, and the next, seemingly determined that not a single living thing should survive in Dresden. There seemed to be no end to the horror, said Eva Bayer.
So there we go. That's from chapter 4.
There may be some folks out there, probably not many, who do not know the story of Dresden and how it was singled out, a town that hardly been damaged during the war, but in early 1945, Stalin more or less insisted that the U.S. and the British do something to help his Red Army move across and take some of the heat off of them. And I'm not sure who mentioned it, but Dresden was the location where they wanted to make a statement. And Dresden, by the way, was considered it was a showplace on Earth. It was a beautiful city. It was full of beautiful cathedrals, art museums, churches. It was a glorious, beautiful place where lots of people throughout the world came for vacations before the war, of course. But on this night, this would have been Fasching. Fasching is the German equivalent of Mardi Gras. On this night, in the last winter of war, Dresden had a population of roughly 1.5 million. 600,000 who normally lived there, and another 800,000 people who were refugees from the east, fleeing the Red Army, fleeing the horror that was the Red Army. And many of them landed in Dresden. And so we have a city that's packed, literally packed with people. Men, women, children, old men, the old people. Every place that could be occupied by a human being was. And yet, on this night, a few of the Dresdeners themselves decided to go out in their costumes and celebrate, as I said, Fasching, the Mardi Gras. But the Americans came in, the British came in, I believe it was, first around midnight. And like I said, Dresden was their target, a place to make an example to the rest of Germany. And at first they blew the town to bits, destroyed everything with their explosive bombs. And then a little bit later, an hour or two later, I forget exactly how long, but in came the planes carrying the incendiary bombs that are fire bombs. And their design was to do nothing but stoke fires, start burning everything that was crumbled and crushed. And of course they did. It was a terrific firestorm. And ultimately, after 24 hours of, several hours of nonstop bombing, but raid after raid, the entire city was in flames. And it's been estimated that the death toll for Dresden was anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000 people dead. Interestingly enough, for your listeners, I'm sure many of them have heard this also, but the modern day account of Dresden, that is people who think they know more than the people back then did, are estimating there was no more than 25 or 30,000 people killed in Dresden that night. And these are people today making that estimate. I'll tell you what, I'll take the people living there at the time and those who came in to examine what had happened from Berlin and from Switzerland and neutral countries. I'll take them and the International Red Cross, who gave me this estimate of anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000 any day over what modern day propagandists would like us to believe. I suppose their idea is we'll limit the number of people killed by making these wild, stupid under assumptions. And thereby decrease the crime itself. That's their thought process, I'm sure. But there is simply no way a town with 1.5 million people crammed into this inner city that could be utterly destroyed, that could be bombed and blasted and then incinerated. No. I go with the Red Cross and the bureaucrats from Berlin who did the estimation back then.
Right. Alrighty, we will be right back.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
Alrighty, we are back. And my guest today, are Michael Thomas Goodrich. His website is thomasgoodrich.com. And Paul English, the narrator of Hellstorm, his website is hellstormaudiobook.com. And I would like to share something with you regarding Dresden. When I was writing my trilogy, like Mike, I do a lot of very, very deep research. I don't have the first person type. Mike writes with such passion because he does bring in the individuals. He's got something that no one else that I know has. And I love him for that. And let me share a document that I found and referred to it in one of my books, and also made it known on the internet. It's from German History and Documents and Images, Volume 4, Forging an Empire, Bismarckian Germany, 1866 to 1890. And it's called Manifesto to the Governments and Peoples of the Christian Nations Threatened by Judaism, the First Anti-Jewish Congress in Dresden, September 11th through the 12th, 1882. In the following manifesto of the First Anti-Jewish Congress held in the Saxon capital shortly after the first wave of German anti-Semitism peaked, participants wove virtually all the threads of the Jewish question into the fabrication of a monumental struggle against international Jewish parasitism, claiming that all Christian nations had no choice but to recognize the Jew as biologically alien. It called for a reversal of Jewish emancipation and for the expansion of an anti-Semitic movement of self-protection. The meeting's delegates constitute a virtual who's who of German, Austrian, and Hungarian anti-Semites at the time. Now, this is a 10-page document, but please note the date, the place, September 11th, 1882. They met for 2 days. And so Dresden, I suggest that Dresden, inasmuch as it was non-military. Of course, whether it was a military target or not, every city in Germany was bombed. They first bombed all the cities above 50,000 above, and then they went for everything. No matter how small the town was, they were going to destroy not just Hitler, but every single German. And Dresden was a target, a definite target. The other thing that I find interesting is that FDR and Churchill both held the similar positions in the government, in their respective governments during World War I. And then they followed through by becoming the heads of state to follow through with World War II. And World War I, between World War I and World War II, the Allies were simply reloading. They were simply devising more bombs. It was just a cessation of active warfare so they could rearm re-indoctrinate people and devise lies about World War I against Germany. The Germans came into Belgium. They were cutting off the children's hands, and they were cutting down apple trees, and they were doing all of these terrible things which weren't true. None of it was true. But they needed time to rearm and to further their indoctrination, their programming of their respective populations. anyway, I just want to share that, this document.
That's interesting about Dresden. I didn't know that. It had an ancient target on its back, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I will send you this document. I'll send both of you this document.
Thank you.
I think I've seen it actually, but it was great for you to go through that, because when I was first seeing you, obviously you're aware of this sort of never ending infinite revenge pattern that exists over on the other side.
Yes.
And I think the thing about Dresden as well is it was just a matter of months before the war ended. You think about that. I mean, the more I've thought about that, that's the bit that really gets you. It's not, even if there'd only been, you know, 5,000 people in there or whatever, the whole, it reveals the nature of the sickness towards it in terms of eradicating German life. That's another goal.
Okay, gentlemen, we will be right back in 3 minutes. We are back, and our guests today are Michael Thomas Goodrich, the author of wonderful, wonderful books, including Hailstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947. Our other guest is Paul English, who is the narrator of that book, Hailstorm, and you may acquire that book. It's an audiobook at hailstormaudiobook.com. Alrighty. We have time for some more, files, audio files. We have about 20 minutes. If you have some others.
I think Paul has gone. I think he'll be back shortly.
I was here all along. What I did was for the break, I stick myself on mute. Then of course I forget to unmute.
Oh, I do that too.
There you go. That's good. Yes. Everybody does it really, but I'm quite prepared to admit my stupidity in public.
Well, I just did too.
Oh, it's great. Why don't you do it too, Mr. Goodrich? You need to mute yourself and forget and come in. See, we can all do it then. That'd be great.
Yeah. I hate to admit it, but I never mute. I forget to mute and I slip off to go get a drink or do whatever people do. And then I come back, and hopefully I've made no noise putting the headset back on, but I need to get with the program. I need to get a little more professional about this. But
I got a clip here anyway. This is from, what chapter is this? I don't even know what this clip is. This is a couple of minutes, 2.5 minutes. The Devil's Laughter is from that, which is chapter 5, I think. Here we go.
North of Silesia, the plight of trekkers in East Prussia was even worse. As isolated Wehrmacht units desperately defended their shrinking Baltic beachheads, millions of refugees poured into the coastal pockets. Unlike the situation at Breslau, military authorities to the north could not simply order superfluous civilians from their lines. With their backs literally to the sea, only the slow and treacherous evacuation by boat was an option. Consequently, at Memel, Königsberg, Kolberg, Danzig, and other besieged cauldrons, the situation was appalling. Jürgen Thorwald describes the chaotic conditions of Pillau, where thousands of refugees sought shelter. Every alley, every street was packed with their vehicles. People were waiting in every harbour shed, in every wind-sheltered corner. Among them stood their beasts, bleating, snorting, lowing. The pregnant women giving birth somewhere in a corner, on the ground, in a barracks. Some of them had been raped on their flight, and now they were trembling for fear they would give birth to a monster. The strangely pale faces of girls going up and down the streets asking for a doctor. The wounded and the sick, in constant fear, they would be left behind, concealing weapons under their blankets to force someone to take them along, or to end their own lives if the Russians came. The orphans, who had been saved from their asylum somewhere at the last moment, and tossed onto carts with nothing around them but a blanket, and who were now lying on the floors with frozen limbs. The Russian prisoners of war, brought west under orders from above, walking on wooden soles, their tattered overcoats held together with paper strings. The old people who had lain down in some doorway at night and had not awakened. The hungry for life who found each other to mate among the ruins in broad daylight. And the wild-eyed insane ones who rushed from house to house, from wagon to wagon, crying for their mothers or their children. Over it all, the grey sky, snow, frost and thaw, and thaw and frost and snow, and the chill, chilling wet.
There, The Devil's Laughter. That was from chapter 5.
Yeah, that excerpt is from the chapter, as Paul mentioned, of the people trying to escape by any means possible. In this case, those up in the northern part of Germany, and their only way out was by boat. And I don't think Paul's going to play another clip on that. Stop me if you are going to do that, Paul. But
no.
The world's greatest nautical disaster was not the Titanic, was not the Lusitania, even though we've had a lot of documentary programs and books written on both. The world's greatest nautical disasters occurred at this time that Paul was talking about in his narration. On the Baltic Sea, when ships, sometimes they were old cruise liners or freighters, or even smaller boats, were crammed packed with people trying to escape the land by sea to get to a safe place in Germany. That would be the western part, which was still in German hands. And so you had this incredible mob of civilians trying to get passage on whatever ship was available. On the Wilhelm Gustloff, it was an old cruise liner.
Yes.
Built to carry roughly 2,000 people and crew. When the boat finally left port with its cargo of terribly frozen refugees, it had roughly, by the time it left harbor, roughly anywhere from 9,000 to 10,000 refugees on board. And once it got into the sea, there was lots of ice still in this black Baltic Sea, and at that night, two torpedoes from a Russian submarine hit the boat, and even though the ship didn't sink right away, and the people were encouraged to go back in out of the 20 below degree razor sharp wind, the boat did finally start turning over and started to capsize and sink. But that ship went down, and I think only a few hundred at most survived, but it took with it roughly 8,000 to 10,000 people. That is the world's greatest nautical disaster. Nothing even comes close. Certainly not the Titanic with 1,500 dead or the Lusitania with 1,200 dead. We're talking here anywhere between 8,000 and 10,000. This happened over and over and over again. Not as many people as was on the Wilhelm Gustloff, but 5,000 on one ship, 4,000 on another, 2,000 on one ship that actually made it to safety, but was bombed by American bombers as it docked, as it tied up to its dock. 2,000 went down right there in its slip. 2,000 people died right there in safety. This is just part and parcel to World War II. This is, and I've got to say this, the Russians knew what they were doing. They knew these were refugee ships. There was no large German naval vessels still floating on the Baltic Sea at this time. They were all smaller ships or had been sunk or blown to bits in their ports. So the Russians knew, that is the Soviets knew, that these were refugee ships, and yet they still went ahead, just like Dresden, just to kill as many Germans as they possibly could. This is going on all over Germany. This just happens to be on the Baltic Sea, but the firebombings are continuing. The targets of opportunity are continuing. As you mentioned, Deanna, the bombing of even small towns now to kill as many people as possible. You know, here's an interesting fact nobody knows much about, I don't think. But after Dresden, after this hideous firebombing of Dresden, in which anywhere from 250,000 to 400,000, nearly half a million people died in 24 hours. There was a bit of contrition, you might say, among Churchill and other people suggesting that this may be excessive, what they just did in Dresden, the slaughter of people, this massive massacre that occurred. And yet, 2 weeks after Dresden, the small city of Forzheim, I can't tell you where that's at. Yeah, roughly 50,000 people was bombed 2 weeks after Dresden. And I think it was something like 10,000 people died in that bombing too. In other words, the contrition be damned, they still went ahead with their program of trying to kill as many Germans as possible. This is, there's so many other ways we could talk about this, a deliberate, intentional attempt to kill all Germans. It's, whether it be the trekkers, as Paul mentioned, trekkers. They called them trekkers because they formed these large treks of wagons trying to escape to some place of safety. Oftentimes, maybe most times, these were overtaken by the Soviet armored units, and they were simply squashed right in the middle of the road. The tanks didn't try to go out of the road. They would just simply run over the entire trek. We may be talking something a couple of miles long, actually. Men, women, children, babies, animals, pets, all squashed as flat as cardboard. Cardboard. People talk about it being as flat as cardboard. So the massacre, the slaughter, the sadistic, and Paul made a note too that, this is toward the end of the war. Yes, it is. There's no doubt now in anybody's mind that there is not going to be some German secret weapon that pulls their chestnuts out of the fire. Germany is going to lose a devastating war, a devastating defeat, and no doubt a devastating peace is coming up too, which is true. But still, the massacre went on because guess what? The Allies knew there wasn't going to be any war crimes trial for them because they're winning the war. They're going to win the war, and they will be the ones who dictate the terms of the peace. And that is, they will also be able to set up their own courts to try the German war criminals. In other words, they've not only won the war, but now they're dictating the terms, and they're also writing the history. So that's what happens when you win a war like this. You can do anything you want. You can project your own crimes onto the defeated, because there's no way they cannot. They don't have any newspapers. They don't have any radio stations. They don't have any authors that will have a best-selling book out there telling their side of the story. And that's the way it is until this very day, mostly. We're getting nothing but the victor's version of that terrible slaughter fest, that sadistic Jewish hate fest against all Germans, all Europeans, all whites generally. That's what we've got to this very day. And when you know the truth, like you and Paul and I and hopefully hundreds, thousands of your listeners, it's a very frustrating thing to hear people mouth of things about the good war and honor the greatest generation and to go on and on about the 6 million dead Jews and to just continue and perpetuate this winner's version of history right up until now, 70-some years after the war. It's offensive. I find it extremely offensive that people can still say those things when the truth is out there. All they had to do was show a little curiosity, click their mouse, plug on Deanna Spingola, and hear the truth. Or many other, thank goodness, many other websites and podcasts and radio stations that are doing the very same thing. It's out there. It just takes a little bit of curiosity, a little bit of effort, and you can do it. No, someone like myself who writes these books, and I'm sure Paul who narrates these books, we continue. We will not stop because it is offensive to us that these lies are perpetuated and continue. And I guarantee you, none of us, of the three of us, none of us are going to stop. And let's face it, our goal is that everybody knows the truth. It's at least going to be out there. And it's something like this too. I think, Paul and Deanna, you'll both agree. We're never going to reach the unreachable. Those people who will always ignore the truth, will always take the safe, pleasant way out of something rather than accept the truth and work for it and act upon the truth. But books like this, books like yours, Deanna, were never really intended for the, to reach the unreachable. We're trying to reach those people out there who have that strong curiosity gene, who refuse to be lied to, who know something's rotten out there, but they're not quite sure what it is. That's the people we're trying to reach. These natural curious, the natural leaders of our people. So that when they finally get a hold of the truth, then they will do something. I guarantee you, because, I made an analogy the other day and it's something like this. There are fissures in the earth, fissures. And we're trying to fill those fissures. We're trying to fill them with the reachable people out there. And eventually, when we get those fissures filled, then we're going to have an earthquake. And the other people, yes, they will simply, as they've always done, be, weakness is drawn to strength. And our leaders are strong. And they will be drawn to these strong leaders because that's what weak people do. And that's our ambition, basically, is to reach the strong, make them stronger yet, and then the rest will follow in suit. The weak will always be there following because they always have. Right now, the weak are still following what they consider the strength out there. And that's the World War II Good War narrative type of thing. And what they read and see and hear on television and movies. But ultimately, that's coming to an end. And we all three sense it, feel it, know it. And that's why we continue to do what we do, because it doesn't seem like it's coming with the speed of light. But, hey, I'm older than all both of you two. And I can see it coming maybe a little bit better than you guys. It is coming. And are we going to make it to see that day? I don't know, Deanna. I'm going to hang in there and try to see that day come.
As am I.
A little bit like the Berlin Wall. Who could have predicted that coming down with the speed of an avalanche? Who could have predicted that? I certainly couldn't have. That's critical mass. Europe reached critical mass then. And that's what we're hoping for right now when we're talking about World War II. Critical mass among the people when they finally all get it. And when they finally all have to get it, because it's not going anywhere, it's just going to be in their face every time they turn around.
Right.
I do go off on the tangents, as you know.
Yeah, I love your tangents. They're wonderful tangents. The other thing, too, is that when you look at some of the people, some of the people who participated, such as Eisenhower, and that he set up 200 encampments to house Germans who made it through the war. And these encampments, they had no buildings. They were mud. They had no food, no water. And there were 200 of them. And he was, of course, rewarded with the presidency following that. While he was in Europe and, directing some of the warfare, he had a driver that was his mistress. He was just a piece of garbage, same as Churchill. Just big pieces of garbage. Anyway, we have a quick break and we will take calls in the next hour. We will be right back. Alrighty, we are back with our guests, Michael Thomas Goodrich, the author of Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947, came out in 2010. Notice that it covers 3 years. It's filled with heart-rending first-person accounts of what happened. And then our other esteemed guest is Paul English, who narrates the book. His website is hellstormaudiobook.com. And,
you know, Deanna, maybe this is a place for me to get in a shameless advertisement, but my most recent book was a follow-up book to Hellstorm.
Right. Yes.
Called Summer 1945, Germany, yes. Japan, and the Harvest of Hate.
Oh.
And you can tell from the subtitle that not only am I talking about Germany and what it went through, but
yes.
also Japan.
Japan.
And anybody who's read that book, I can tell you that they know that Japan went through very much of what Germany went
exactly.
through.
Exactly.
And Paul mentions that Dresden was totally unnecessary. The war was won by the Allies. They had absolutely no reason on earth to destroy this beautiful, magnificent city and nearly 500,000 people.
Right.
Well, that's to say, I could say the same thing for Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes.
It was the very same thing. It was simply Americans could show off their power. They could test the atom bomb. They could perhaps,
and that's what they did.
Do a fake on Russia to show them that we've got the bomb, you don't. But they had no, there was no reason. The war was already lost for Japan. They've been trying to surrender since January of 1945. And yet the Americans still went ahead with this.
And bombed them.
Yeah.
Just, and oh, terrible. That book is, I have it sitting here on my desk. Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. It's a must read also. In fact, Paul, you should do this one next. I know that we talked about that before, but if you could narrate that, it would be super.
Oh, I probably could. My only sort of comment about it was that it being more of an American
right.
situation, it might be more appropriate to have an American voice narrated.
Oh, but your voice is so good. It's okay.
It's universal as far as I'm concerned. It's the universal English. And don't forget the Brits were involved in the war, the Pacific War also, Paul.
Absolutely.
With Japan. And,
yeah, I know. My dad was stationed out there. That's where my dad was involved with.
Oh, really?
Okay, so then you...
Yeah, he was in the Royal Navy, and he was out in Singapore and places like that. So he was a very young man at the time, so...
Both my dads were involved in World War II. One, an island-hopping Marine fighting from Guadalcanal all the way to Okinawa.
Yep.
And another dad, a adoptive dad, who fought in the European War. So, yeah, I love both of them, but, you know, there was no way for them to have an alternative view then. The same culprits had the newspapers, radio.
Right.
So that was they did what they thought was the right thing at that time.
That's right. They did.
All right. We're at the top of the hour. We will take your calls in the next hour at 800. What is our phone number? 800-313-9443. Be right back.
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Truth.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guests today are Michael Thompson-Goodrich, the author of numerous books. Just before the break, you mentioned Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. It's a must-read book, as well as Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947. His website is thomasgoodrich.com. And our other guest is Paul English, who is the narrator of Hellstorm. His website is hellstormaudiobook.com. And while Hitler was putting men to work, women to work, not women. He encouraged them to stay home and have children. While he was putting 7,000 men to work, there was a big depression here in America under FDR. And of course, it was totally different than what was happening in Germany. Germany was moving ahead without the help of bankers, without usury, and it was a wonderful thing. Alrighty, we do have some phone calls. Shall we take some calls?
Works for me.
Okay. Let's see, where are our calls? Okay, we have John in Texas. John.
We have Mark here.
Mark's in Philadelphia. We have John in Texas first. He called in first. Do we
have... Hello. You know,
yes,
James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Hello?
Pardon me? John?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. You know of James Corbett of the Corbett Report?
Yes.
He has come out with a three-part series called the World War One Conspiracy, which gives the true background and causes of the First World War. And he laid it at the feet of a secret society that was created by Cecil Rhodes in the early 1890s and seconded by Lord Milner.
Could you come closer to your mic or something?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. That's better.
All right. World War, it's called the World War One Conspiracy, and he claims, I have two questions really. He claims that this Milner group was the one that set up both the Boer War and the First World War with Germany, because Germany was becoming economically, there were two objects to it. It was to destroy Germany as a military and economic rival to the British Empire, and it was to recover America to the British Empire in a de facto sort of way, out of an alliance, in order to bring that Britain might and America would in unison create a new world order that would rule the world. And to do that, they created the Federal Reserve to finance it. And here comes my second question. About 350 miles south of Halifax, Nova Scotia, there is a shipwreck broken into, where that true identity is now is seriously come into question. And it has been suggested by some, one of them being John Hamer, that this ship was sunk on purpose as part of an insurance scam. But this was later morphed into a mass murder directed at getting rid of three men who were opposed to the creation of the Federal Reserve and the facilitation of World War One, they were opposed to the inflation that it would cause. It would threaten their own fortunes. Was this ship the same ship that the ship that sank on April the 15th, 1912, and the wreck thereof, the same as that one that was launched on May 31st, 1911? And was it sunken deliberately as part of an attempt to create the Federal Reserve?
Gentlemen.
And your comment.
Well, I think the Titanic, is that what you're referring to, I guess? There's
Certainly, was it, and what was it? Was it the Vanderbilts that were on it? Or somebody else? I can't remember.
But it was they were definitely not. Guggenheim, John yeah. Jacob Astor, Benjamin Guggenheim, and Isidore Strauss.
Yeah, it was the Astors as well. I think they're big. They were definitely in opposition to the formation of the Fed. That's true. And I believe that it seems that there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that the actual ship that sank was not the Titanic. It was its sister ship, which had, they swapped them around because they'd been in a, there was a massive collision in the shipyards of Harland and Wolff, a couple of years before. And there's a whole series of sort of, yeah.
It was with a battle cruiser of the HMS Hawk.
That's right.
It was
there was some kind of a maneuvering thing,
It was the result of a miscalculation on the part of the, helmsman of the Hawk. The rudder was jammed and it got sucked in by the Olympic's weight and it crashed into its stern area and that created a huge triangular hole in it that, broke the screw mechanism, or was it the crankshaft and the screw, and it also bent the keel, which was the key part.
That's right, yeah, it was particularly badly damaged, I think, according to many of the reports I've seen as well. So, and it, obviously it was to someone's advantage. You know, you always ask that one, Ki Bono, who benefits from those people going down? So they cleared the way. They would have been very strong oppositional forces to the formation of the Fed, of that there's no doubt. The other point you mentioned about Cecil Rhodes and the Round Table and Milner, that's all pretty true. Milner was the head of that steering committee. Rhodes died relatively young. Rhodes did have ambitions that were pretty big. But you also have to understand, or at least take into account, I would suggest, that who they were bound in with financially. Lord Rothschild was part of the group. So I suspect there were many sort of crossovers, but there's an account from the American ambassador who was in London about 1906, and I think he's talking to Lord Grey, and Grey went on to be a pivotal figure during World War One. And there's some kind of, I'm going to muller this when I paraphrase it, but the point you raised about Germany's industrial might is absolutely true. And basically, by the time we got to the late 1800s, early 1900s, the effectiveness of British industry had been surpassed by the effectiveness of German industry. This is correct. And so there was a discussion along the lines of the American ambassador, whoever it was saying, well, why don't you just compete with them? And I think it's Grey who said, no, we'll have a war instead. And this is that sort of hubris, that arrogance that creeps in. And I think Lord Acton can come in now where, you know, the phrase power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So they were definitely a pivotal part of the causing of all that kind of stuff. But I suspect there were other forces at play as well. I personally maintain, as a Brit, that there was no such thing as the British Empire. That might sound a bit cack-handed, but what I mean by that is there wasn't an empire that was by, of, or for the benefit of the British people at
right.
all.
Right, oh, right, absolutely.
It didn't exist. If I'd have been alive back then, I would have been out on some field shooting some poor sod, or he would have been shooting me, and we wouldn't have had much choice about it, and that's what was going on, and there... Wives and children were back at home in the 1800s in these terrible workhouses, mm-hmm. Which Dickens describes. So, you know, it's not all jolly Brits having a great time and we were all rolling around in money. It's nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an empire of the City of London, of which Rhodes and Milner were thick as thieves with that lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once you're in a world like that, you get a disproportionate sense of your own abilities. And there's a certain type of British person that is like that, and they're very, very different from the likes of the British people that I know. Very different.
World War One added, I think, 1 million square miles to the British Empire. It did not.
It may well have done, whatever that means, but yeah, it probably did. The Queen apparently owns a lot of land, but she doesn't do very much with it. So, you know, if you want to grow potatoes on it, get stuck in is what I would say. I mean, I don't think she's going to come around and cause you any trouble, but yes. Yeah,
also,
probably.
Lord Asquith, who was the Prime Minister at the time of the Titanic sinking, I think also at the start of World War One, he was a member of this Milner, of this Rhodes Milner group.
Yes.
And he was, and there's someone that suggested that he was, or was he an accessory after the fact, was he in on it from the beginning through the machinations of the Rhodes group and its connections with the Rothschilds and indirectly, and his, and of course, their other front man in the U.S., J.P. Morgan, owned IMF, International Mercantile Marine, which also owned the White Star Line. It was
right.
Also engaged with Harland and yeah. Wolff, correct?
Yes. Yeah, but I would view Asquith as being on the second or third tier of power there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really. I mean, all, you know, like we're saying, Tom was saying earlier, that, you know, you've not been in charge of your own country in America for quite a while. Well, make that even longer for over here, because we've had a central bank since 1694, so you can start round about then, right? The you know, ever since that thing kicked in, this nation has been at war with someone every single year except for 3 years, I think, over the last 350.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not aware of British people getting up on a morning and going, God, we must have a war with someone. You see, there's a force. There's right. a force organizing and bossing us around. And after they've made use of British manpower, obviously it made sense to make use of American manpower. You've still got the job. It's not a job that you want, but you've got it. And we're fighting the same thing. Of that, there's no doubt.
Right. Well, anyway, that's all I want to add. If you had any, your opinion about this, about the, whatever ship that was sunk there, when was it, do you think that it was part of all this?
Yeah.
I think it's irrelevant that's my opinion. People don't understand that if you look at the real history, of how we were talking about the Federal Reserve and all that, that was done by Congress. And, there was a quorum. Nobody went home during the Christmas break. It wasn't passed without a full quorum of both the House and the Senate. So, they needed to do that in order to form the Federal Reserve. They knew exactly what they were doing. And so you really have to lay the blame where it is deserved to be laid. And that is with, the government of this country as well as the government of Britain. I won't say Great Britain, of Britain. And there was a meeting where they decided that they would work together and pool the resources, pool the loot that they acquired from engaging in war as allies together. And that was held in 1899, I believe, or maybe earlier. And it was the first Zionist Congress.
1897.
Okay. Yeah. That's when
Basel,
it was held.
It was in Basel, Switzerland, right?
Yeah. Alrighty. We need to move on to some other callers. So... thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, John.
Take care. Alrighty, we have, what do we have? Mark in Philadelphia. Mark?
Good afternoon, Deanna. Good afternoon, Michael, and also Paul. That curious gene you talked about, Michael, I definitely have it. Just very briefly, I was born in the Midwest. Turns out that a couple years ago, I knew I was German. I had German blood, but I didn't know much about my father's side, who was full-blooded German. Turns out that, here's the thing. Does truth matter? Does history matter? Does personal heritage, the heritage of our families, matter? I say it does. All in the name of love. And does can love exist without truth? So here we go. I turned out a couple years ago, I found out my great-great-grandfather was here in Pennsylvania, where I'm at now, and he was in the Civil War. He was mustered in, you know, he was drafted, okay, fighting for Pennsylvania for the, supposedly, later they told us it was about slavery, freeing the slaves. Anyway, he was in the Battle of the Wilderness. First day of the battle, he was captured, taken to Andersonville, Georgia, to Andersonville prison, and he was there for 11 months. He survived hell for 11 months in a 65-acre open-air prison where there was no food, no water, or little thereof at any point. But he survived. So, and then I also found out that my father, my natural father, was in World War II at the end. He was just old enough to be drafted. And then my grandfather, his father, went in 2 days after Pearl Harbor, and he was just young enough, 1 month away. He would have been 42, and the age cutoff was 42. Now, they served for all the flag waving for freedom and all of that, but all of these lies in the name of war. The Civil War was a lie. That was a lie. All of these lies. Evil, 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 evil. And now, in the churches in America, we have them talking about love and all this. We have churches that are promoting World War III, okay? And they've been lied to. All these lies we've missed. I went down a rabbit hole. I didn't read Hellstorm. I watched the visual presentation of Hellstorm. And I've learned a lot through you, Diana. I wanted to say that I wanted to ask, and this is a thing, Deanna, I'm sorry I called you Diana, it's Deanna. I wanted to ask you, Deanna, you know, we got a lot of people talking about the Nazis this, the Nazis that. Well, then we find out that the term Nazi is actually a
you cut out on us. That's not a term that the Germans applied to themselves. Are we still on?
Yeah, well, I'm still here.
What happened?
We lost our caller.
We lost our caller.
At the moment.
Yeah. The so-called Civil War was actually the first successful Marxist revolution in the world. And a lot of the people that served on the North had come out of Europe after the failure of their efforts in 1848 to instill communism in Europe or Marxism. And so they came over here and fought on the North with the North. Okay, so we lost Mark. Maybe he'll call back in. Meanwhile, let's take Daryl in Austin.
Hello, good afternoon. I have a question about, your guests are very knowledgeable about the past and have dug up many details and the causes of a lot of these problems. Could they put on their glasses and, are they at liberty to talk about what they see present day as, the causes and the problems now to associate it with similar things in the past?
Okay, we're going to a quick break and we'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good.
Alrighty, we are back with Mike Goodrich and Paul English. And we had a gentleman on the phone that asked a question. That was Daryl, correct?
Bill, yes. Yes, to your guest.
Okay, what was your question?
The question is the past has been exposed very explicitly by your guest. Could they, are they at liberty to speak about what they see today since they've done such good research in the past?
I'm a little confused. Is it Bill or Daryl we're speaking
with? I'm not sure.
Well, sir?
Bill. Oh, Bill.
Okay, they have you as Daryl, but okay.
I do tend to look ahead, try to see ahead. I suppose I've been given a bit of a vision since I'm older and I've worked with history. And, you know, if you understand what happened in the past and what's happening in the present, you'd be more likely, I think, to look ahead and see what's probably going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. To be quite honest, I see better times ahead for us. It's some of the things that I've seen occurring right now around the world, especially in the white world, of course. That's where my focus is. There is some extremely good signs for hope ahead. Most of it has to do with indefatigable people like Deanna, people just like Deanna, and the Internet. And it's there, and people are accessing it. People are learning truth. People are becoming outraged. And they're the sort of people, this is the better part of it, the sort of people who act on this sense of outrage, they understand that this is a very bad place we're in right now. The world, the white world especially, we're facing annihilation. Extinction. And more white people are starting to figure this out. And it's not just any type of white people. These are our best and brightest who are figuring this out. And I won't go too far with this prediction, but let's face it, all of us have lived through the Berlin Wall. And that's how quickly history can change. It can happen overnight, and it still can. Even though at times it may seem improbable, it's the sort of thing, we talk about critical mass and a tripwire that will actually cause an explosion. That is not too far in the future, as far as I know, as far as I can see. It's something that's it's viable. It could happen. And yes, there will be a radical transformation in society once this happens because, as I mentioned, the best and the brightest are now on our side, coming to us. And these are the people who can make change in the world. It may not, the kind of change we want may not be all that we hope for initially. But let's face it, how many, let's just say 10 years ago, who could have predicted someone like Trump, who said all the right things. Unfortunately, he's not doing too much of the right things right now. But nevertheless, we were voting for a man who was saying what we wanted to hear. And we thought, even if he can't deliver on what he's saying, most of it, at least it's going to give us the time to think and to do and to act and to gather our forces. And mostly that's what has happened. Now, in other words, I can't really say with accuracy what will happen 5 years from now. But I'm saying stay in this fight because we're winning. Do we have the time to actually claim victory? That's the scary part that I don't want to go saying something negative here. But I hope I've in part answered some of your question. I don't see doom and despair ahead, quite honestly. I see just the opposite. And people like yourself who are listening to this program or calling in, that's an action in itself. And we're getting millions of people just like this now who are starting to take charge, tired of the same old that we've been going through. And it's a different sort of person that's coming along right now. So please keep the optimism high in your mind, in your soul, in your heart. Don't give up. Don't let somebody else, don't say, well, we're going to win this thing because a historian thinks we are. No, it means that you have to redouble your efforts, fight even right. harder to make it happen sooner.
Right.
Paul, you got a thought on that?
Well, yeah, I think these are actually very encouraging times. even though it may still yet get worse before it gets better. But the reason why I'm encouraged is that I think that right at the very root of things, something's shifting. And I really do think that over here, of course, we've got this, we have a situation where democracy absolutely died on March the 29th. And like a little shockwave that's building, it's rippling out across the whole nation. And even bovine-minded people that pay very little attention to anything much other than whatever are beginning to get it instinctively that we don't live in a democratic country. And I'm quite pleased about that, to be quite honest. It's a start. Very good.
Good. All righty. Thank you, Bill, in Austin. We'll be right back, and we'll take Mike in Kentucky. Be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
Righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests are Mike and Paul, and we're talking about Hellstorm, the audiobook, and we're taking callers. And we have Mike in Kentucky. Mike? Yo, Mike.
Good afternoon. Okay, yes. Now we can hear you. Now you can
okay.
hear me. So, you know, Assad, he's a eye doctor. He's, you know, he's obviously an intelligent guy. And whatever his purposes are there in Syria, I don't think, you know, whatever he wants to do, it's a, you know, it's something like a 1,400-year-old culture just going from the Muslims. But now, obviously, there's a lot of embedded Christians down there. And I saw a picture, and I'd never heard this. I went all the way through school, and I feel like, you know, in America, we're supposed to have a free, adequate education. And I have to wonder how many people went all the way through school, through college, got a degree or two, and never heard the term Holodomor. Has anybody heard that term? Holodomor?
Yes, of course.
Well, there's a picture of a Bashar al-Assad somewhere in, I think, East Germany, and this is how I found out about it. Somebody passed it around as a meme on social media. Fortunately, it was not censored like they're trying to do. A bunch of stuff is being sent down Orwell's memory hole. So this is the exact type of stuff they're trying to erase from knowledge, the Holodomor. Now, Assad laid some kind of a lamp, flower pot with a lamp in it on a memorial to all the German Christians that were killed in the Holodomor. Now, this predates the Third Reich. I don't know if you guys know about much. Do you have any idea on the numbers? I mean, that would make it, generationally, there would be living memory of people from 1917 through to whenever Hitler came to power that would have had friends and relatives and just heard about all of the Bolshevik murders that happened.
Right.
You know, in the tens of millions. So it would not be very hard at all to rally a bunch of Germans to demonize Jewish people if they knew that they were out there killing Christians in the Soviet, you know, revolution. And
well, a lot
there's
of those,
Solzhenitsyn. There's
a lot of those
Solzhenitsyn.
People that were settled in that area that suffered from that horrid starvation and enforced famine were originally from Germany.
Right. So, I mean, that had to have traveled by word of mouth, even if it was kept out of the media. And so for, you know, 20 years, people knew about it, you know, going into the 30s. But the Solzhenitsyn quote is very ominous, too, if you've heard that quote, where he says, the reason you don't know about this is because the media is in the hands of the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, you put those two events together, if you know somebody and you can hit them with it, because I tell you what, we're going to have to hang together. We're all going to hang separate here. And they're trying to get rid of any independent media that there is out there. They're also trying to eliminate any consumption of media that is not in your X key score file. If you know about X key score this week, there's two different federal rulings this week around the Fourth Amendment here in America. For those who are listening overseas that don't know, the Fourth Amendment is about being secure in your personal papers and effects and having privacy in your personal life. And the government can't just kick in your door like the Redcoats did with a general writ and just rifle through your stuff on a fishing expedition looking for anything that they can take you down with or cause you problems with or cause you to go spend all your money on in court trying to defend yourself because you have to have an approved lawyer and spend $5,000 defending yourself because of something you posted online, okay, about knowing about the Holodomor and you're labeled anti-Semitic. We know about Ernst Zundel, and I have to wonder, you know, I was offered a free trip to Israel to go over there and see some of the sites, but given the stuff that I posted online, once I get in their jurisdiction, are they going to arrest me? I have no idea in this day and age. What I was getting at is, with the media in the hands of the perpetrators, and you know, they're profiling everybody. These two rulings this week heightens the absurdity that we are now in America, with our government saying that in one federal district court in the upper Midwest, the Fourth Amendment is violated when a police officer chalks your tires to see if you've been parking somewhere too long. But this other judge says we cannot rule on the secret surveillance stuff because it would reveal, you know, it would reveal sources and methods, and it would be a violation of some kind of, I don't forget what the legal mechanism he used, but basically you have to be able to prove that you are damaged in some way by this surveillance that they're doing. And for a decade, I've been trying to get the Electronic Frontier Foundation to look into my case where this has been happening. Like, and people don't realize it, but the phones, the shadow banning that's going on social media can happen with the phones. And so I've documented all kinds of fun stuff with that. And so we really have to soberly, I think, realize that they will give you enough rope to hang yourself out here on these social media platforms and even on the phones, because within 10 words, when you say it on the phone, your voice print is cataloged by these computers. The Israelis sold Boeing, an aircraft company, you would think, that they sold something called NARUS, N-A-R-U-S. It's, and there, these machines are in every node, that or fiber optic data goes through, and the Israelis get a copy of everything that the NSA sees. So when the NSA in the last few weeks say, oh, well, we deleted a bunch of stuff that we didn't have the authority to collect, the Israelis still have it. What's her name? Smashes her Blackberries with a hammer. The Israelis still have it. They have everything they need to blackmail and control our government.
Mm.
And that's not just in this country. It's not just in this country. That's all around the world, because National Geographic in 2015 printed a fairly accurate diagram, cartoonish it may have been, of the world's fiber optic network. There's a footnote at the bottom in that centerfold diagram that says all of the world's phone metadata is less than 1% of what they're collecting. So that's the reason Bluffdale has to be so big and all the rest of the Anglo-American Empire computer complexes that Israel is a part of, and William Binney and Snowden don't mention that. It's sin by omission. When they talk about the Five Eyes, when they talk about this surveillance network, this dragnet that's going on, they curiously do not mention Israel. But Snowden leaked that, and Assange, I think, also confirmed it, that whatever they're gathering, Israel gets a copy of through this network of NARUS devices. So they've stylized. I've got a heck of a book there if they would let me publish it. I don't think they would. I can't find a lawyer to help me out. 20 years of this I've been dealing with, going back, I think, about 6 years before the Patriot Act was passed. I noticed what was going on. And I posted a video in 2009 on all the American broadcasting ABC network affiliates that I could, and NBC, because I had access to what they call their FTP, File Transfer Protocol, folders for both commercial production and news production. Not one damn reporter called me back and said, quit posting this, because I kept going back and posting it. It was called Bandwidth Bandits. When I called Electronic Frontier Foundation to try to tell them about this, they said, oh, we don't have the bandwidth to handle your case. And this case this week, the Electronic Frontier Foundation says, in order to sue the government, you're going to have to prove that you're damaged with it. Well, by golly, I've got people that are willing to say they, and numerous hundreds of witnesses to this happening, because I broadcasted on the local TV station that I've been running since the late 90s, basically. And so the fact that I can't find a lawyer that's got any cojones or whatever to take this case just shows how much control there is now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I finally got William Binney to message me back on a certain forum. J. Kurt Wybe won't message me back. Larry Klayman won't message me back. And these are guys that are supposed to be hot, you know, into this whistleblowing network, you know, that they're making money on the speech circuit or whatever. And, William Binney says, well, a lot of people have tried to find lawyers and can't, so I can't. He says he can't find a lawyer to help with his stuff, but I mean, Larry Klayman helped get him out of his, where they were trying to claim that he was leaking classified documents, and they showed that it was documents that had already been declassified and the prosecutors had lied to the court. So that got him immunity, supposedly. But now this, what I'm getting at is if you're going after this, you need to be fully aware that they are, you know, there's hardly no way to be anonymous anymore with your political views. And so if like the whole of DeMar, like say I've got two college degrees, I went all the way through school, nobody ever mentioned this. And I was always curious, how did they get the Germans to demonize the Jews so bad that they would do this? If in fact it's true, then you find out Auschwitz plaque has been altered twice and the Red Cross didn't say those numbers don't match up and you can't even talk about these facts.
Right. I think the numbers is 276,000 people died totally.
Work camps, retarded people, they rounded up homosexuals because that, I guess early on in the Soviet Union, homosexuality was not banned, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it became banned later, but it was, because it was the Jewish people that were, I guess, that hated Christians, by the way. That's one of the things that Solzhenitsyn points out. These people that did the Bolshevik Revolution hated Christians.
Mike, you should email me.
No, I might. The Solzhenitsyn quote's pretty easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's weird because I came across that Holodomor memorial thing that Assad did and the quote from Solzhenitsyn within about a month of each other. So
wow.
I just like, light bulbs went off in my head. I'm like, oh, you know? So, the other thing I want to mention was the whole thing about the Civil War was a fraud. How can you declare a quorum when most of Congress went home for Christmas? I don't think all of Congress knew what was happening.
They didn't.
With the federal.
They did go home.
Yeah, it was a fraud. The whole thing was a fraud.
The whole thing was a fraud.
You have to also look at the Civil War. How could they declare that the Union was dissolved? They still had a quorum.
The Civil War was just a Marxist revolution. But
And all the ten planks are in place. All the ten planks are in place. What ten plank is not in place in this country, and it's been that way since at least the 40s. And what is that? The big act that created the headless force branch of government, the Administrative Procedures Act, and the victory tax. So we've fully in place all 10 planks of the Communist Manifestos for 80 years. I mean, it's just undeniable. The Marxists have taken over. They control the media. You don't get taught this stuff in school. I still have a standing offer for a silver dollar if somebody can bring me my 7th and 8th grade American government book that did not print the entire 14th Amendment. It only printed the first paragraph.
The original 13th Amendment is very interesting too. But we need to move on.
Okay, two copies in my hands of the 13th Amendment on hemp paper and rebound volumes, and they were two separate volumes, so
absolutely.
They were published in 1822 by Kentucky. It was ratified.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you go.
Right. Okay, hey, thanks. Okay, let's take Joe in Indiana. Joe is gone? Okay, let's take Erica in Illinois.
Hello.
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 Yes, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I want to first say thank you to all of you, Deanna and Mike and Paul, for putting the time in to share the real truth. And I know that oftentimes it makes you unpopular with people. I first wanted to extend that, my gratitude.
I think I know who Erica is. She's a lady who has her own website, a live stream called The Harsh Reality. Am I wrong?
You are correct. It's actually on YouTube. And I have my main channel is called The Harsh Reality, but it's got a strike, and I'm on my backup channel, The Harsh Reality, and I'm number three. the truth that I like to speak, but that's okay.
Yes, a hard-hitting program. Erica so kindly had me on a month or two ago. It's really hard. Erica's, she's the about as strong as they make them.
Well, thank you. You're very nice. I wanted to kind of reflect a little bit about an earlier caller when he was talking about, and you were responding to, the what white people are facing now, and it kind of really hit me hard when I found out that before the World Wars, there was Europe made up 30% of the world's population, and now it's only 8% of the world's population, and that is just striking. There's no doubt that the clergy plan is in full effect, and I refuse to accept defeatism because that's what they want. But the reason why they're hitting everybody so hard, especially with laws like, for example, H.R. 336, make it illegal to boycott Israel, is because they're afraid, because people are waking up and people are searching for the truth. And,
you're right.
These
are acts of desperation, acts of fear. These aren't acts of strength.
No,
if you were strong,
right.
Truly strong, you wouldn't need to do such radical things that's going on right now. So let's take heart
that's
in
true.
That alone.
Right.
Our job,
that's
I think,
right.
in
and
many
then,
ways, is to laugh at them. I'm
right.
quite serious. They're not to be taken
yeah.
seriously. Like this goofball that's just been, whining on the United Nations, and then this law passed in Florida, and if you even think something now, you are to be detonated on a field or something, or whatever garbage they're going to go with. Our job is to laugh at them. Seriously, this. And the other thing that I'm taking a lot of encouragement from is we are now, more and more of us are talking about white people worldwide. We never used to talk like that. We didn't need to. We're just, it's like the strands are pulling it together. There's nothing they can do about this. There's nothing we can do about it anyway. Which is great. It's just nature in operation. It's just going to come back like a tidal wave.
State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court.
And it's funny how. Oh, is somebody talking? I can't.
Are we having a break or no? Okay, go ahead, Erica.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
I was just saying, and it does really take a strong will to stand up and face all the criticism and all the pressure people are going to put on you. Number one, and it's for various reasons. But a lot of people don't want to know the truth. But once you see the truth, you can't unsee it. Others, they'll maybe be jealous of your strength and they'll try to subvert you. There's so many things that go on, but you know what? I draw my strength from Thomas's, you know, Mike Thomas Coolidge's book, Hellstorm, and I think about the horrors that those people went through, and nothing can come even close in that I would experience in my life that would even come close to what they had to go through. So I think about this, and when I wake up, it's in the back of my mind every day. And I've made it almost like my life's mission to continue on. I mean, I've just experienced, you know, some major drama, I'll just say, because I didn't like something that I saw, and I spoke up about it and being attacked, but I don't care. You know, that's fine. But, you know, we have to not just talk the talk, we have to walk the walk. And we have to stick together and support each other when things like this happen. And also keep in mind that there's a lot of people out there who are willing to join in this battle. They just maybe need a little bit of help towards what the truth is. And so, again, I want to thank the three of you for providing those platforms and the time. You know, the emotional effort that you all put in to help bring this truth out, you know, it certainly has changed my life.
Thank you.
I wish I could say that, well, honestly, there's nothing else I personally can do. This is my niche in life, and it's hard for me to take a thank you for something that right now is totally natural. I mean, it's sort of like, I think you know what I'm saying, Erica. It's way beyond me now. This is something vastly more important than my life or my death. Mm-hmm. It's something greater, vastly greater than that. And you're right about us coalescing, circling the wagons for one another, and fighting to the death if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting to the very end, because what they did to our German brothers and sisters during World War II, they would love to do to us right now.
Yes, they would.
You don't have to look too far to know that what they're doing right now on college campuses, in the media, organizations like the SPLC, ADL, whatever. That's what they're working for, desperately working for, is our demise. It's not going to happen. Like I say, it's an act of desperation. Unfortunately, they needed more subtlety. They don't have it in their DNA. Now we're all starting to see it. It's all becoming perfectly clear. And guess what? That's what I mean by be positive, be optimistic, because we are going to win this. So many of us, just like Erica.
There's another point I wanted to make. Think about all the years they had to put into this process of propaganda and brainwashing.
Yes.
And let's look at how fast the waking up is compared to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the waking up process is a hell of a lot faster than all
You're
those years
right.
That they put in. Yeah, it's been over 100 years now that they've been doing this.
And I wonder if you could pity them, because all that work, all that time, all that money, all that energy, all those decades, and now we're doing it in days and weeks and months, really quickly, supersonic speed here. No one foresaw the internet, cyberspace, the information highway. No one foresaw that, and that's good.
Right.
They're living in the days of smoke signals. We're living in the day of the future right now.
Right. So I do feel optimistic. I do, you know, don't get me wrong. I do have days where, you know, I might feel down and whatnot, and that's normal, and that's okay. But I also remind myself, you know, I just look, take a good look around, and I'm like, no, things are gonna be okay as long as we keep on. And how, you know what? I don't care. I'm gonna fight. I'm fighting till the end. So no, whatever happens, happens. You know. So.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Erica, are you there?
Oh, okay. I'm sure. I wasn't, my phone was going out. I'm sorry. As far as My guess, my point then is there any plans, like maybe in the future, of something else? You know, I sometimes will hear, you know, there's organizations or this or that, or you know, if what do you think it might happen, like in the next 5 years, as far as resistance and whatnot springing up?
Was that directed to me, Erica?
Anybody, either, you know, three of you.
I don't know really, Erica. I think it's just a matter of process. It's just a matter of the process. Oh, and here's the process kicking in right now.
Yes, that.
Thanks, Erica.
What a pity.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And other callers.
And you've done a great job. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you, Deanna, so much.
Nice being here, Deanna. Yeah, been great.
Let's do this again.
Good.
Okay, take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
All righty.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Chat with you next week. Bye-bye.